Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 4th, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group teleforum conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing telecommunications policy and the FCC. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we'll diverge a bit from our typical format. Our teleforum call will proceed in the form of an interview of FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai, conducted by Greg Sopkin. After the interview, Commissioner Pai will take questions from the audience, and I think our expectation is the interview portion will last about a half an hour or so, leaving a full 30 minutes or so for your audience questions. Gregory E. Sopkin is a partner at the D.C. law firm Wilkinson Barker Knauer LLP. He's been practicing energy and telecommunications law for over 15 years, and he was the chairman of the Colorado PUC for January 2003 until January 2007. His complete bio, along with Commissioner Pai's bio, is available on our website and in the notice you received at today's call, so I'm only briefly introducing him, and at this point, let me turn things over to you. Mr. Sopkin, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean, and I'd like to thank FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai for taking the time to participate in this Federal Society teleforum conference call. My name is Greg Sopkin. I'm filling in for my law partner, Ray Gifford, who had to be at a hearing today. Ray and I practice telecommunications and energy law at Wilkinson, Barker, and Knauer. I'm sure you all know the accomplished background of Commissioner Pai. He was nominated to the FCC by President Obama on May 7, 2012, and he was confirmed unanimously by the Senate. And on May 14, 2012, he was sworn in. I will skip the lengthy accomplishments in his bio other than to say he received a BA with honors from Harvard in 1994 and a JD from the University of Chicago in 1997, where he was an editor of the University of Chicago Law Review, and he's had a storied career after that. I personally went to the other UFC, University of Colorado, but we won't talk about that. Well, what you may not know about Commissioner Pai is his deep and abiding love for AM radio and his love for his alma mater, the University of Chicago. As it happens, longtime University of Chicago professor Ronald Coase passed away at the tender age of 102 earlier this week. So in my effort to channel Ray Gifford, I will attempt to also channel Ron Coase in my questions to Commissioner Pai today. So I'm going to go through a few questions here in an interview format, and at some point, probably around the 25-minute or half-hour mark, I will ask for the audience to be let into the conversation and ask questions. So let's start, Commissioner Pai, with Professor Coase's, one of his seminal articles. This one appeared in 1959, the Federal Communications Commission, where he first formulates the famous Coase theorem and, more importantly, calls for using auctions to allocate spectrum resources. While it only took some 30-plus years for this to become conventional wisdom, it is still the case that the nation is considered spectrum scarce, and auction rooms and allocations still inspire huge controversies and rent-seeking attempts. With Coase in the background, how would you describe the current spectrum situation, and why is it so hard to get more spectrum into the hands of those who value it most?
Oh, Greg, that's a terrific question. Let me start off, though, by thanking you, Dean, and the entire Federal Society for giving me this opportunity to speak with you and your members. I'm a longtime member, going back to my time as a student at the University of Chicago Law School, and I say it because I truly believe it, that the Federal Society is such a unique opportunity to discuss public policy issues, especially communications related issues, in a forum of open engagement and dialogue. So I thank you for that. I also appreciate the mention of Professor Coase. It has been a pretty momentous week at the law school. As you can imagine, it's in fact, in the light of his passing, I took an opportunity to reread that 1959 article and was struck by how radical, in a good way, his ideas were at the time, as juxtaposed by how commonly accepted those ideas are now. You know, spectrum auctions are really a universally accepted means of distributing through government fiat, essentially, you know, a scarce resource, which is the airways over which signals travel. And one can only imagine when it was essentially just Professor Coase and a former law student, Leo Herzl, making this argument, how uphill the battle must have seemed to have been. And actually, if you wouldn't mind me quoting from page 24 of that article, which I have in front of me. He says, it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that the widespread opposition to the use of the pricing system for the allocation of frequencies can be explained only by the fact that the possibility of using it has never been seriously faced. And from our vantage point today, I mean, considering how many billions of dollars have been raised for the Treasury, how much more spectrum has been pushed into the commercial marketplace and allocated to the highest valued use, precisely because of this pricing mechanism that Professor Coase advocated, it's really just impressive, the power of his ideas. And I think it makes it even more incumbent, going to the meat of your question, it makes it even more important for the FCC to accelerate its efforts to bring more spectrum into the commercial marketplace. You know, needless to say, our spectrum needs on the consumer side have intensified greatly since 1959, even over the last 10 years when you think about it. You go back to, say, 2003, you know, there were no smartphones, there were no tablets, and even the way that people were using consumer devices was relatively meager. I mean, they were using it for voice calls or text messaging, but now, you know, it seems like everybody is using a mobile device to view video, to do social networking, and for other spectrum-intensive applications. And you know, the problem for us, of course, is that you know, the supply is relatively limited. Part of that is because we haven't allocated as much spectrum as needed for the commercial side. A lot of these you know, frequencies are in use already, especially by the federal government. And part of it also is that we haven't really made as aggressive use of auctions as we can and as we could. So back in 2010, the FCC in the National Broadband Plan proposed to make you know, 300 megahertz of spectrum available by 2015 and 500 megahertz of spectrum available by 2020. But thus far, 3 years later, we still haven't held a single auction for additional spectrum. And in terms of some of the unlicensed spectrum that we've examined, I mean, we've finally started the process along, for example, the 5 gigahertz spectrum back in December of 2012, but that process is still in its infancy. So one of my top priorities, if not the top priority, has been to really establish a comprehensive, forward-looking spectrum policy, not to be reactive and just, you know, push different little bands of spectrum out into the marketplace you know, on an ad hoc basis, but really to think comprehensively about where a consumer demand is going to be in 5 years, in 10 years, and in 20 years, because, you know, the commercial operators are going to have to operate under the same assumptions. And so I hope that's not a too long-winded a way of answering your question, but it's all which is to say that you know, we take our inspiration from Professor Coase, and hopefully we'll continue to apply the lessons of his teachings in the future.
Yeah, I actually read the article before this interview as well, and it just strikes me as how prescient he was about the subject. He says, once the rights of potential users have been determined initially, the rearrangement of rights could be left to the market. The simplest way of doing this would undoubtedly be to dispose of the use of a frequency to the highest bidder, thus leaving the subdivision of the use of the frequency to subsequent market transactions. So it seems like a pretty simple concept. How do the auction timelines affect this? And do you know how the broadcast to broadband incentive auction could be expedited?
Great questions. With respect to the incentive auction, the time frame is a little bit in flux for a couple of reasons. One, the FCC, as some of the participants on the call might know, is currently short-staffed. We lost our chairman and another commissioner earlier this year, and two nominees have been proposed by the president and are under consideration by the Senate. And so by tradition, the acting chair doesn't tackle bigger picture issues until a permanent, or sort of defers those for the consideration of the permanent chairman. And it's difficult to think of a more high-profile issue than the incentive auction. Nonetheless, though, we are proceeding on a staff level to do some of the nuts and bolts legwork that has to be done for the incentive auction to happen. And the timing issue there is that a lot of the matters are very, very technical and complicated. My office, for example, has been spending a tremendous amount of time on trying to think about the best way for the FCC to structure the band plan. That is how the spectrum that's being used currently by television broadcasters should be converted over to use by the wireless folks. And it seems like a pretty simple proposition, except when you consider that different broadcasters in different markets might choose to participate, and so you have a different amount of spectrum in every market. How should the band plan look? Should it be a single national band plan that applies in every market, or should it be variable? What are the questions about interference and those kinds of things? And that's just the band plan. I haven't even gotten into, the actual design of the auction, the repacking by which the television broadcasters would be moved to a different part of the spectrum. These are highly technical questions that are pretty difficult to sort out. Needless to say, they're difficult for lawyers like me to sort out, but even the engineers and economists are struggling with it as well. So I guess the two main inputs into the answer to your question are personnel and sort of technical solutions, and those are two things which I really don't have direct insight into, except to say that we will work with all deliberate speed to get those tasks done.
Okay, well, let me turn to another subject. Next week, the oft-debated, ever-controversial open internet order will be argued at the D.C. Circuit in the Verizon versus FCC case. What is your opinion of the FCC's open internet order, and what will be the aftermath in the event that either the D.C. Circuit affirms the order or, as a lot of people are predicting, the FCC is overturned?
Both good questions. So with respect to the first, I've stated publicly that I would not have voted for the order had I been on the commission at the time. And the reasons for that are severalfold. First, from a legal perspective, I do have some background in this issue, having worked at the FCC when the FCC adjudicated the BitTorrent complaint a few years ago. And in the wake of that decision, which was overturned by the D.C. Circuit, it seemed to me that the FCC lacked the legal authority to regulate broadband internet network management decisions made by private operators. And I think that initial judgment has just been confirmed over time, notwithstanding some of the other cases that have come out recently out of the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court, the D.C. Circuit being Silico Partnership and the Supreme Court being City of Arlington. I nonetheless think that the FCC, as a legal matter, lacks the jurisdiction to issue these kinds of decisions. But even assuming legal authority to be solid, I think as a prudential matter, the FCC should probably refrain from asserting jurisdiction here. This is one area where there was a longstanding bipartisan consensus to not apply some of the more heavy-handed common carrier regulations to the internet. And that started with then-Chairman Kennard back in the late 1990s during the Clinton administration. It continued under Chairman Powell in the second Bush administration, who decided to deregulate cable service. And it continued under then-Chairman Martin, who took a similar approach to allowing Title II carriers, telephone companies, greater access to IP-enabled networks without the threat of regulation. And so, I think it's hard to argue that the internet hasn't been innovative over the last 10 to 15 years. And I would argue, in addition to that, one reason is that regulators have been, generally speaking, restrained in what they're willing to do. Now, that said, if the D.C. Circuit decides to affirm the open internet order, the question is what will happen? And I would expect that you would start to see some complaints, whether a flood or a trickle, I'm not sure, alleging that a particular ISP violated the rules by doing this or that, whether it's a consumer or an applications developer. And then the question for the FCC would be, in adjudicating that complaint, what procedures would apply, what standard would apply. And I think, unfortunately, of necessity, you would see the FCC starting to get into some of the more micromanagement style second-guessing of how these private companies operate. And I don't think that would be a good thing for the companies, obviously, but ultimately not for consumers either. I think that consumers have benefited, as I said earlier, from the fact that this is an area where innovation has been allowed to flourish without the threat of government intervention.
Well, concerning network management decisions, turning back to Coase once again, Coase said in his article, it is not easy to understand the feeling of hostility to the idea that people should pay for the facilities they use.
Right.
Would Coase counsel that a usage-based price mechanism should be used to allocate resources to users without the need for government regulation?
I certainly would think so. I mean, unless there were some demonstrated systemic anti-competitive harm that was being worked on consumers by a provider. If it's a monopoly, for example, charging super competitive prices, and that's one thing. But in a pretty competitive market where the vast majority of Americans have a choice of which internet service provider to use, I certainly don't see evidence of a market failure that would justify an FCC or any other governmental mandate, for that matter, prohibiting the use of usage-based pricing. One of the points I've made is that it's pretty commonly accepted throughout the American consumer experience that people pay for what they use. So not every restaurant is an all-you-can-eat buffet, I think with respect to the internet, it should be accepted that usage-based pricing is a useful way of price discriminating in a good way to prevent the heavy volume users from being subsidized by the grandmothers who might only use the internet for sending an email every now and then, for example.
So price discrimination is not a bad word?
Well, I think in this case it's not, because the alternative is, if you prohibit usage-based pricing, then the prices for the vast majority of users who are not heavy users of the internet are going to go up to compensate for the folks who are, for example, downloading movies all night from Russia or whatever it is. And so, I think it is a useful tool for managing network congestion. It's a way of keeping the roads open, so to speak, for everybody.
Well, God knows those Russian movies are tempting. Let me turn to another issue. I know you're very interested in the idea of possible process changes at the FCC. Coase says that in some circumstances, for example, where the cost to operate in the market is high, we might be willing to acquiesce in the regulatory process and the resultant misallocation of resources resulting from the FCC's lack of knowledge, inflexibility, and exposure to political pressure. With that in mind, what process changes should take place at the Commission to make it a more efficient agency?
That is a question that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, in part because I was a staffer here for many years, and it frustrated me then and does now that so many people who come to the FCC seeking relief, whether it's a request for a waiver by an AM radio station in Georgia, or it's a big telecommunications company or a cable company, or even just a public interest group, they file a petition for something and it just sits there for a long time and nothing ever happens to it. And I think that does a disservice to those parties and, frankly, to the American public. I mean, they expect their agencies to be more responsive to the American people. And so earlier this year, I made a speech at the Federal Communications Bar Association in which I outlined a number of different solutions to this problem. I certainly won't belabor each of them here, but in general, some of them included, the greater use of deadlines in our work. Quite often, we never set deadlines for ourselves, and the result is, naturally, that just the process of bureaucratic inertia swallows up a lot of the initiatives that are otherwise ready or should go out the door. Secondly, I've suggested that we use sunset clauses more frequently, especially in a dynamic industry like the telecommunications industry. I think it's important for us to remember that what a new rule that might make sense in 2013 might not make sense in 2014 or 2015. And so if we adopt a sunset clause that requires affirmative FCC action in the future to prevent the expiration of that rule, then it requires us to constantly revisit the underpinnings of the rule to make sure that the rule matches the realities in the marketplace. Another one is adopting sort of procedural rule, something akin to the Supreme Court's use of the cert process. So, for example, we have a number of subordinate bureaus here at the FCC, the Wireline Bureau, the Wireless Bureau, et cetera. If one of those bureaus makes a decision, and an outside party doesn't like it, they have to file an application for review with the full commission. And under the law, that party can't go to court unless and until the full commission, that is, you know, the five commissioners led by the chair, issues a decision. Unfortunately, there's no requirement that the FCC act on any of these AFRs. And as a result, parties never get the relief they seek, and they can't go to court. And so one of the proposals I made was to adopt something by which if the FCC doesn't act within a certain period of time, say, you know, 90 days or 100 days or 180 days on an application for review, and if no single commissioner requests plenary consideration of that application, then the Bureau's decision is automatically affirmed and its reasoning is adopted as the commission's own. And that would give people a little more certainty and the ability to go to court to challenge what we do. Just the final one I'll put in a plug for is just to be more transparent. I don't know if any of your listeners have used the FCC's website, but it can often be difficult, to say the least, to try to figure out how the FCC is doing. And so I would propose putting on a single website all of the metrics that measure the FCC's performance. You know, how many petitions for reconsideration are pending at any given time? How long have they been pending? Has the FCC resolved it? If so, how long did it take to resolve it? Somewhere where anyone can go and understand, you know, how efficiently the FCC is working. And I would posit that the mere fact that this website exists would incentivize the agency to move more quickly. So in a not-so-brief nutshell, those are some of the ideas I put out there for process reform, and I would hope that it would make the FCC more responsive in the future.
Yeah, as somebody from a state commission and who practiced before state commissions, I could tell you that the entire Colorado Public Utilities Commission is subject to a sunset itself every few years and has to justify its existence. And virtually every type of case, there is a shot clock, and the commission does have to make a ruling within usually 210 days of the filing. So certainly would be very interested in that, in those kinds of reforms. with regard to the Federal Trade Commission, it has some plausible claims to jurisdiction in the internet space, where there's no common carriage or other plenary regulatory scheme. And Professor Koh said, in fact, the antitrust laws do apply to broadcasting, and recently we have seen the Department of Justice taking action in a case in which the FCC had not thought it necessary to act. End quote. Would FTC jurisdiction and its antitrust lens of thinking be welcome, or rather would it be unnecessarily additive in the internet space?
That's a question that spurred a lot of discussion recently. I know one or I think maybe even a couple of the FTC commissioners has talked about that recently. And I am myself, I'm a former antitrust lawyer. I worked for several years at the Department of Justice's antitrust division in the telecom section. And so, you know, I bring to the question a firsthand appreciation of the power of the tools of antitrust when wielded reasonably and thoughtfully. That's a question I've struggled with myself. There are certain issues that obviously are within the FCC's core competence. We understand how these communications networks have developed over the decades and how they, as a commercial matter, how they operate. On the other hand, obviously, you know, the DOJ and the FTC have antitrust expertise that is useful with respect to any regulated industry. And so, I think when it comes to concurrent jurisdiction or even one of those agencies supplanting our jurisdiction, I think it's an important dialogue to have. And, to be honest, I have, as I said earlier, I sort of struggle with the question myself. I think the worst outcome would be to have numerous agencies taking, comprehensive bites at the apple, because then, the regulated entities have no certainty, which is necessary if they're going to make major investment decisions. So whatever the rules of the road are going to be, I would hope that we take the least disruptive approach as we review these the decisions made by internet operators.
Okay. Turning now to carriage fights, we've seen many of these in the news lately with Time Warner Cable and CBS, as well as Dish and ABC, among others. To Channel Coast once again, and this is the last time I'll do it, bargaining doesn't seem to be subject to many transaction costs here. Rather, a bilateral holdout seems to be occurring where one or both parties think they can get a better deal from a political regulatory process than a negotiation. So what is the FCC's role with regard to these carriage fights?
So it depends on the specific area, but generally speaking, when it comes to retransmission consent, for example, which was the subject of the dispute between CBS and Time Warner, the FCC's statutory authority is relatively circumscribed. We have the obligation to apply what is known as a good faith standard, that is to make sure that both the broadcaster and the MVPD, or multi-channel video programming distributor, are operating in good faith in terms of negotiations. The problem is that in real time, it's difficult for the FCC to figure out what that standard means in practice. We can request information from the parties on an ad hoc basis, but there's no sort of formalized process for us to understand in the middle of the negotiations exactly what is going on. And I think part of the debate on Congress has been, should we either, remove the FCC's authority here altogether and let the market sort out how these negotiations transpire, or should we give the FCC more authority to allow it to more aggressively intervene in some of these negotiations? And I think that's the debate that we're going to see in the lead up to the reauthorization of the STELA, the Satellite Television Extension and Localism Act, which expires in December 2014. And depending on what Congress does, it'll be our job to implement that authority. There's also broader program carriage and access requirements that the FCC is charged with administering, and with the caveat that I haven't yet had a chance to really dig into the decision, the Second Circuit today issued a decision regarding program carriage in which it rejected a First Amendment challenge, as I understand it, to some of the FCC's rules, but overturned on APA grounds the standstill requirement that the FCC adopted back in 2011. This is before I joined the commission. And I think that although the decision went against the cable operators in terms of the First Amendment challenge, I do think it's important for everybody to remember one passage in the court's opinion, and that is, if you'll permit me, the court concludes that, quote, intermediate scrutiny is the appropriate level of review and that the FCC program carriage regime satisfies that standard. While rapidly increasing competition in the video programming industry may undermine that conclusion in the not-too-distant future, that time has not yet come. Now, one of the things I've talked about is the fact that video competition is intensifying in recent years, especially among young people. I mean, young people don't think of the video marketplace as simply the cable company and only the cable company supplying linear programming on a television screen. I mean, they might think of it as a YouTube channel that they watch on their mobile device. And so I think as this marketplace evolves, you're going to see this question about the FCC's statutory and, frankly, constitutional authority bubbling up much more frequently. And that's a difficult question that I think the agency and the courts are going to have to confront in the very near future.
Along the same lines, does the FCC have a role with regard to a la carte?
My own view is that we don't. I think that in terms of the distribution of video, that the marketplace has generally worked pretty well. And if consumers have a particular preference, they can either cut the cord altogether if they want and go with an over-the-top provider. If they do like the multiplicity of programming that they get through a more linear provider, they can do that. But once the FCC starts to toggle with what they think of as the optimum method of distribution, then you can easily disrupt the entire business model for providing video. And that's something that I'm generally loath to do, especially given my own free market instincts.
All right. Well, I'm seeing that we're coming up right about at 3:30 Eastern. So I think now would be a good time to open up this call to audience participation. Dean, can you go ahead and do that?
I sure will. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you're in our audience, after you hear that announcement, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. So hold on one moment. So once again, if you have a question for our guest today, FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like we get started with two questions in the queue. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy with the Committee for Justice. My question is, some years ago, there was a lot of talk about diversity initiatives at the FCC. I mean, they didn't come right out and say that they wanted broadcasters to have quotas, but certainly the goal seemed to be to have more minority owners and perhaps more minority staff. I don't know. I was wondering if that ever went anywhere. I haven't really heard much about it, and if it's still something that we need to be concerned about.
Thanks for the question, Kurt. That particular proceeding hasn't gone anywhere of late, but the question of minority ownership has remained a live issue, primarily in the context of our media ownership proceeding. We're required by law, as you probably know, to consider every 4 years whether our media ownership rules required or continue to be necessary in the interest of competition, and if not, to tweak them appropriately. This is an issue. These media ownership rules have been tied up in court for quite some time. The Third Circuit has twice reversed the FCC's decisions. Right now, we are, believe it or not, in the 2010 quadrennial cycle, so we're now over 3.5 years overdue to revisit them. But one of the more challenging questions is that the Third Circuit required the FCC to explain how its rules would promote minority ownership. And you know, I've tried to promote what I believe are free market, race-neutral ways of accomplishing that goal. So, for example, you know, right now, believe it or not, every other segment of the communications industry can solicit and get foreign investment above 25% in terms of an equity stake. But if you're a broadcast holding company, you can't do that. So, for example, it's possible for a Japanese company, say, to invest over $20 billion in a Kansas-based wireless company. But it's against the law for somebody to invest you know, over 25% in a Kansas AM radio station. That strikes me as absurd. And so, especially when you consider that broadcasting has been one of the primary ways that minorities have gained ownership of communications properties, it seems to me that we should strike what I consider to be a relatively anachronistic restriction on foreign investment. So that's one example of a way that I think we could accomplish the goal that some would like to accomplish in terms of diversity of ownership without getting into the very difficult questions about compliance with Adirond and you know, some of the precedents that follow that. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
Before we go to our next caller, let me make a brief announcement about our upcoming schedule. This Friday, September 6th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to examine the extent of regulatory authority in some of the agencies, and the EPA in particular, under the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. That is Friday at 1 p.m. And then on Monday of next week, we'll have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, when we'll welcome Jeff Manny looking at the Verizon versus FCC case, oddly enough, which is being argued that day in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And with that, again, if you have a question for our guest today, FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one more question in the queue, and then our lines are open.
Good afternoon, Commissioner Pai. I was gratified to learn early on in the call that you're a big proponent of AM talk radio. I track a lot of AM talk radio, at least political talk radio, and something I've noticed is that revenues, you know, obviously derived from advertising, come from ads. If you listen, all it takes is for anyone to listen to an hour of AM talk radio, and what you're going to hear are hair loss replacement, gold bullion, doomsday seed banks, herbal mail revitalization remedies, dubious identity protection rackets. These are the types of things that are providing the revenue to pay for the licenses when they're auctioned off. And I'm curious, that with an aging population, it looks like we've got a bunch of predators, you know, a Wild West mentality of manipulators taking advantage of the elderly marks. And that doesn't sound like a healthy marketplace to me. And I'm wondering if you view it as, you know, at all part of your responsibility to make sure that the products that are being sold, where the revenues are being derived from, you know, reflect, especially with the country getting older.
Well, thanks for the question. One of the issues that we face at the Commission is that there are a lot of consumer complaints that the FCC simply doesn't have jurisdiction over. And unfortunately, one of those is the actual content of advertisements. So unless there is some kind of conduct that is harming consumers, for example, you know, substituting telephone carriers for old people without their consent or that kind of thing, the agency can't necessarily take action. But one of the things that I would suggest is that there is a way for us to solve that problem through a multi-step process. One of the things I've championed at the FCC starting last September was revitalization of AM radio. It seems to me that such a vibrant part of what was once a vibrant part of our media landscape is sort of withering on the vine, and partly that's because the FCC hasn't updated its rules for AM radio in 22 years. As a result, there's a lot of interference. If you ever try to get an AM radio signal in your car, you know what I'm talking about, especially compared to AM. And I would argue that that has a direct result on advertising. And the reason is because when people want quality content, whether it's music or news or other forms of information, they're going to tend to start with FM radio because they know that AM isn't as reliable. And so as a result, you know, the advertising that AM radio stations are able to get might not necessarily be of the high quality advertising as you've conceived it. And so if the FCC can revitalize AM radio by, for example, updating its rules regarding nighttime broadcasting, removing some of the outdated rules, one of which is called the ratchet rule, for example, that effectively prevents AM radio stations from making improvements to their facilities and other kinds of technical improvements, we can make AM radio comparable in quality to FM radio. And as a result, advertisers are going to be just as drawn to the AM side of the dial as they currently are to FM. So I think that would be a much more, you know, market-friendly way of accomplishing a solution to the problem that you've identified. And just for the record, by the way, I have stashed all of my gold bullion in my house, having succumbed to some of those advertisements.
Once again, our phone lines are completely open at this point. If you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we wait to see if there are more questions, Greg, let me see if you have another question for Commissioner Pai.
Sure, and just following up on the last caller, some of us believe that male pattern baldness is a deeply important issue to solve in society. But beyond that, I know you take an interest in AM radio, and I had thought that perhaps Rush Limbaugh had single-handedly rescued AM radio, but is AM radio moribund, and if so, how can it be revitalized?
Well, I think, you know, anecdotally, we can all tell stories about how we used to listen to AM radio as kids, and, you know, we rarely do it anymore. And I think the stats bear that out. It used to be that there was a 50-50 split between listenership on the AM side of the dial and FM. Now, AM radio listenership is down to the single digits among people between 18 and 34, whereas the number of FM stations has actually doubled over the last 20 years. And so I think for a variety of reasons, AM just hasn't thrived as it once did. And from what I've heard from a bunch of AM radio operators from big cities and small cities is that the interference is an issue, and there are other sorts of technical problems they face that the FCC just hasn't tackled for over two decades. And, you know, if you go to the FCC's website and you can look at some of the comments I made about AM radio, I talk about some of the different solutions that people have proposed. One of them that I didn't mention earlier that I probably should is converting over to digital. So as you probably know, a few years ago, the FCC, as mandated by Congress, shepherded television broadcasting from analog all the way to digital. And there have been some suggestions that AM could thrive if we did the same thing for AM radio, so that, you know, whenever people tuned in, they'd be effectively guaranteed to get a much better quality digital signal. So there are different solutions like that that are on the table, and I'm open to anything that I think will preserve that part of the band. fan because, you know, admittedly partly because I have a fond memory of AM radio as a kid, but partly because as a commissioner, I think it's incumbent upon us to remove some of the outdated regulatory barriers that prevent broadcasters and others from doing what they do best, which is connecting people by using communications networks.
Greg, we've got another caller with a question. Should we go to our next question?
Sure.
All right, hold on.
Hi, this is Lenore Ostrovsky. I have a question for you. And this involves the consumers and their inability to get through to the FCC about the misdeeds, the supposed misdeeds of the various broadcasters, particularly the cable carriers, the ones who provide internet services. Though I think one reason that consumers are not terribly interested in freeing up the broadcasters or the cable producers, carriers, to do whatever they want is that everybody's extremely angry with them. And they're angry because they are what consumers consider to be abusive. They provide bad service. They do all kinds of things. So my suggestion to you is that you do something really consumer-friendly on the order of what the FTC did with their do not call effort, which is the single probably most popular thing the Federal Trade Commission has done in my lifetime.
That's a great suggestion. I myself have put myself on the do not call list, and so I personally appreciate what the FTC has done and how they administer the list. I think your complaint or your question is something that I've heard about a lot. I get a bunch of individual complaints from consumers, whether it's on email or Twitter, or even in person from people in my own family, believe it or not. And I think there's a lot of frustration out there. And I think it's one of the things that I've tried to do in the 16 or 17 months that I've had the privilege of serving here is to try to be as responsive as I can and to try to help the agency be as responsive as it can to some of those complaints. So I've met with, for example, our team that handles a lot of the consumer complaints. I've seen how they go about adjudicating those complaints and putting them into the system and following up to make sure those complaints are resolved. And I think it's an important issue. We're, the consumer protection function of the agency is not one that I think is political in any sense. It's the core mission of the agency. And I think that they generally do a pretty good job of doing it, but we could always, of course, do better. Oh, and one way of doing better, by the way, is making it easier for people to access on our website the complaint form and outlining in with more specificity what the rules are for handling those complaints.
If I may make another suggestion, which is that there has to be, if there's certain occurs a certain number of complaints about a particular carrier, that the carrier be hauled up by the scruff of the neck and required to answer them. I mean, that's the problem. Is it's you get the ear of very nice people working at the FCC who say they're there and stroke you in the head and say, it's just terrible. We feel your pain, but there's no enforcement aspect to it, and it wouldn't have to be actual enforcement. It could be simply exposure, which is Verizon now has 50,000 complaints from all over the country for doing the following things. I should think that would be an incentive.
Yeah, and that's one component of the transparency proposal that I mentioned earlier on when I said that there should be a single website where people can view some of the FCC's performance metrics. One component of that would be consumer complaints. And so you could go on the website and see there are this many complaints pending. These complaints haven't been resolved for some time. They involve these carriers or this part of the industry. And I think, as you suggested, sunlight on some of these complaints, either in the aggregate or particular complaints, could really help break that logjam and make bring the consumers and the carriers to the table, as it were, to make sure that these complaints get resolved in a more prompt fashion.
Looks like we have at least one more question from a caller. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Neil Chilson from I'm a bit of a homer because I'm from Wilkinson Barker-Nauer, and I just had a quick question for you about the sort of competition analysis that the FCC often engages in. You know, a lot of the FCC's decisions and even the underlying rationale for the laws that you implement are based on, you know, a non-competitive nature of the market. For example, in cable, in the cable industry or some of the other telecommunications industries, you know. And so my sense is as we face more convergence in the technology, what is your sense of the direction that competition is going? We have a lot of advocates out there. Susan Crawford comes to mind saying that it's an increasing monopolization of all sorts of infrastructure and that that is going to lead to bad effects for consumers. And yet the FCC continues to issue broadband reports that, while the headline might not say there's competition, the facts seem to say that there are. So I just thought your response on that, I'd like to hear that. Thanks.
That's a great question and something that we've spent some time repeatedly over the last many months talking about. I think the temptation too often is to see the glass as half empty when in and by any objective sense, the glass really is half full. One of the examples that I would suggest is the Wireless Competition Report. In that report, all of us found unanimously that the vast majority of Americans, over 90%, have a choice of four or more facilities-based wireless providers. And those providers are offering up devices and services that are better, faster, cheaper than ever before. Yet, nonetheless, the agency was unwilling to make the obvious inference from those undisputed facts that the wireless marketplace is competitive. And you know, that's sort of troubling, and especially when you pair it with the wireline side. There, for example, you know, every year we're required to do a report on the state of the broadband competition. Without question, the marketplace is more competitive than it used to be. You know, at one time when I got into this business, the talk was about, you know, the telephone companies monopolizing, you know, internet service because they had a DSL offering that was better than anything else. Well, now, of course, you know, needless to say, and the cable industry has made significant inroads into broadband. Even wireless is an option. Satellite companies are providing 45 megabit per second services in parts of the country where, you know, those speeds were just unheard of you know, a few years ago. But there too, nonetheless, the agency refused to find that the marketplace was competitive. Now, you know, why is that? One reason is, what I would suggest, especially on the wireline side, is that the law seems to suggest that the FCC can augment its regulatory authority if it determines that a marketplace isn't competitive. So with respect to Section 706, for example, you know, the FCC is empowered to take steps to more quickly accelerate broadband deployment throughout the country. Now, that Section 706 was meant to be a deregulatory provision, but it's been interpreted by some to permit the FCC to do everything from, you know, regulate internet network management decisions to regulate usage-based pricing, all in the name of increasing broadband deployment. But the FCC can only invoke that authority if it determines that the marketplace isn't competitive. Same thing on the wireless side. Some would suggest that the reason the FCC is refraining from calling that marketplace competitive is because then by doing so, it has greater authority to make more restrictive spectrum holding decisions. For example, you know, which carriers can hold what spectrum in which markets. It has a greater hand in terms of blocking or conditioning proposed transactions between wireless companies, even if those transactions might otherwise be welfare maximizing for consumers. And it can take a whole number of other steps you know, to regulate the wireless industry. And I think all of that would be, is especially unfortunate for those of us who believe that the free market has worked well. But it's especially unfortunate because the U.S., by virtually any standard, I think, has set a marker for the rest of the world in terms of deployment. And you don't really appreciate it until you go abroad, or at least until you read about communication services abroad, that we really are the beneficiaries in this country of just an well, I wouldn't say unmitigated, but virtually unmitigated wave of innovation and investment. You know, 4G LTE technology is deployed in lots of this country. I was in Alaska recently where I got 4G service, which is incredible. Same thing on the broadband side. I mean, the speeds we get now are much greater than the speeds you would get in many other developed countries. But I think, you know, some folks always want to point to, you know, different sort of isolated examples from abroad and say, well, they've got it better. You know, South Korea has broadband everywhere and we don't. Well, I mean, the obvious rejoinder to that would be, well, South Korea is a very different country. It's smaller. It's more densely populated. It costs a lot less to deploy there. And so, of course, you know, South Korea in some ways might be seen as, quote unquote, more advanced than the U.S. when it comes to broadband. But I think given the geographic and demographic challenges we have, that, you know, we should be proud of what we have accomplished. And I think the Federal Communications Commission and other agencies should, you know, before jumping into this marketplace and intervening, you really appreciate what has been accomplished and act with great humility and restraint before, you know, disrupting it.
Let me give one more call for questions. If you have a question, our lines are open now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Greg, we've got, looks like, close to 10 minutes left here.
Sure.
I don't see any questions pending. I'll interject if we get another question, but you want to continue the interview, continue the discussion?
Sure. And just to, Commissioner Pai, just to follow up on Neil Chilson's excellent question. You must be a fine lawyer from a fine firm. one of the biggest issues with broadband penetration is getting broadband to high cost, low density areas, rural areas, and one way to do that is through the FCC's Mobility Fund auction. The FCC has conducted the first auction. And I guess the questions are, was that a success in your mind, and do you have any thoughts as to when the second auction will occur?
As to the second, I'm not sure. We've asked for some updates on that score, and you'll know as soon as I do once we have a time frame. As to the first, you know, I've heard a number of things about the Mobility Fund auction, things good and bad. I mean, some folks have found it difficult to participate, or they found the conditions placed on participation too onerous. And I think, you know, one of the things we're in the process of doing in coordination with one of the bureaus here is, you know, making sure that we get the rules of the road clear enough, simple enough, and per the statute, predictable enough so that universal service support, whether it's the Mobility Fund or the Connect America Fund or any of the other funds that are part of the USF, are more rationalized, and so that we can, you know, tailor the funds to where they can get the biggest buck in terms of deployment. So that's obviously a really difficult question, especially when you're talking about high cost areas. You know, I was in Alaska recently, as I mentioned, and you know, I visited some towns. I mean, calling them towns even is pretty generous, but you know, little villages of, you know, say a few dozen people, hundreds of miles away from, you know, cities you've ever heard of. You know, how do you provide a landline link to some of those places? It's a big challenge, and you know, so whether it's, you know, wireline or wireless, I think we need to think really creatively and hard about you know, meeting the promise of universal service consistent with the fiscally conservative approach that I think all of us need to have.
All right, well, let me maybe turn, since we just have a few minutes, maybe call it a lightning round. These are more Oprah-esque questions than COS. What do you know now about the agency and communications policy that perhaps you didn't know before becoming a commissioner?
Oh, that's a great question. So I had a pretty good idea of what the work would involve generally, having served in the Office of General Counsel for a few years. The thing that I guess I've learned that I didn't know before is that even commissioners in the minority can have a pretty significant impact on policy if they choose to. And I've been, you know, I'm not tooting my own horn, but just tooting the horn of the agency process as it's operated for many years. When I say that, you know, the chairman generally does want to work to reach a consensus on a lot of issues. And so, you know, if a minority commissioner has a suggestion for improving a particular order, generally speaking, the chair has been open to doing that. And I'd like to think that in a whole bunch of different areas, we've accomplished and some pretty good results from the perspective of those who champion a free market restrained approach. And we've made, you know, in some cases we've made bad things better, and even when we've had to dissent, which has happened a couple of times, I think ultimately those dissents have ended up, you know, providing a valuable aspect of the conversation. And so those several times when I've dissented, for example, I think that either the courts have borne out what we've tried to do in terms of the Tennis Channel, for example, or they've illustrated the fact that, as I pointed out earlier, the glass really is half full. And So with respect to broadband deployment in particular. So I guess that's the one thing I have found, have been pleasantly surprised by. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And along those same lines, the loan commissioner making a difference, and I'm sure if anyone can, you can. What are your top three priorities at the FCC?
It's hard to list just three, but I guess I would say number one, spectrum. Number two, handling the what I've called the IP transition in an appropriate way, as we migrate from the era of sort of copper and legacy technologies to fiber and more internet protocol based technologies. It's going to be critical for the FCC to facilitate that transition in a pro market way. And so if we continue to conceive of the world as being dominated by copper that's owned by monopoly providers, then we're going to have a much more heavy-handed regime than we should in an era of fiber. And third, I guess I would say process reform. That's something that, as I've said, doesn't redound to the benefit of any particular chairman or president or political party. It's just good government. And so I would hope that, once I leave here, one of my legacies would be to accomplish some process reforms that the entire agency can take credit for.
Let me just ask you one final question along the lines of IP transition. One of the big issues that is being debated and has been debated for some time is next generation 911. And is that an issue that the states should take the lead on? Because traditionally states have been very active in the 911 sphere, but here we're dealing with IP. And is that something that the states should still take the lead on, or are there jurisdictional limitations there, and it's really the FCC that should first be, providing guidance on that subject?
Yeah, that's a pretty difficult legal and policy question that we've thought a lot about. Obviously, Next Generation 911 is a core component of the IP transition, and for those of you who haven't spent time in this field, Next Generation 911 is essentially moving from the old 911 system, which was based on the telephone company operating a copper line between a consumer and the public safety answering point, or PSAP, which you know as a dispatcher, to a next generation model, which is all IP-based. And so you might use a VoIP application or a wireless phone or what have you to call 911, and it will be transmitted over an IP network. The networks are configured so differently, as you know, that there are some suggestions that the state role will have to change. And I think that states will continue to be an important part of that conversation. But obviously, given the interstate nature of IP-based networks, I think it's going to be important for the federal government to be involved as well. And so one of the things we're trying to learn more about is how that relationship should be structured. What works best for the state agencies, for the federal government, and of course for PSAPs and the providers. And I think our end goal is the same. Obviously, we want to migrate all these networks over to an NG911 because those networks are more resilient and reliable. But the question is how the government role should be defined, and that's something that we have an open mind on and hope to resolve in the near future.
Well, I'll turn it back over to Dean, and I just want to thank you so much, Commissioner Pai, for agreeing to this interview.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I apologize for filibustering and or boring you and the listeners to death, but I've really enjoyed the experience and hope to do it again soon.
To the contrary, Commissioner, much appreciated. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai and Greg Sopkin for their time today and for the exchange today. I thought it's been most informative, To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next Teleform conference call this Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, then we'll be discussing agency authority and the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.